If you're looking for more podcasts to listen to, you can search on iTunes for Transpertini, which is a transportation economics podcast made also here at the Open Road Studio. Hello, and welcome to this month's episode of the Bike Portland podcast about bikes and low-car life in PDX, taped here at Open Roads Broadcasting Studio. I'm Lillian Kerbake.
I'm Jonathan Moss.
And I'm Michael Anderson. Each month we go in-depth on a subject that matters to Portlanders who get around without a car.
And we do it in the time it takes the average Portlander to get to work.
It's time for our second annual Year in Review episode.
Here's how it works. We ask readers and listeners to send us their questions. Any question. Especially about the year just passed or the year to come.
And you responded with questions about infrastructure, the good and the bad.
About how to balance negativity and positivity.
And about what you're supposed to do when someone in a car stops for no freaking reason to wave you through a stop sign.
In other words, Portland problems.
So we're going to put 20 minutes on the clock.
Here it goes. Are you ready?
And answer as many of these as we can. And we'll close out the show with our personal predictions for 2015.
We've got a bunch to tackle, so let's get going.
All right, first question. This one is from Kyle. What is your prediction for Barber Boulevard in the next year? Will it be safe? Will it lead? What will lead to change and what will not? Jonathan.
I see the issue of Barber Boulevard heating up quite a bit in 2015. For the last couple years, people have been talking about putting it on a road diet or doing other things. The powers that be have been pushing them to sort of wait and say, oh, let's make it a part of some of this long-range planning project over here or there. Well, now a couple years have passed. There's also a few other things that have changed. Like Michael's reported on the recent ODOT traffic study, it showed we can make serious changes to the way the lanes are aligned, and it wouldn't really cause that big of a slowdown, and it would also have lots of safety benefits. There's also the good news of the BTA actually putting some weight behind it. Their New Year's Day ride, which happens in a couple days, is going to go out there. So I think the heat on that is going to rise quite a bit. Will it actually be enough to sort of melt the glacier of change on that specific project? I would say there's a good chance we could get something moving forward. Anybody else have anything else to say about that?
I think the fact that ODOT was sort of battered into agreeing that they would do this study has led to a bunch of data, which is the language of ODOT. And so now we have a bunch of data on this. There's actually some chance that ODOT engineers are going to be on board. The question is whether political leaders are going to be on board. And I guess there's a lot of resistance on the West Side politicians to this. But maybe the data will actually change their opinions too. Who knows? I think that's the key. It's changed from engineering to a political problem, which is usually our problem here.
Jonathan?
Well, I think just one other thing on Barber is that it's really unlikely anything physical will happen on the road, because even with the new data, ODOT and the other powers that be are really pushing this to be, quote, part of a larger regional conversation about what to do on Barber. Let's make all of our partners aware of this possible. So that kind of language equals at least 8-month planning process. Mm-hmm. So unless it starts in the next few months, we're over a year out.
Which means we just get to postpone the political fight that we're going to have anyway.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah.
Okay, next question comes from Kyle Johnson. Two of the three of you have hand-built bikes. What will it take for the third person, Michael, to get a hand-built bike, and what would that bike be like?
I am the third person out here, and I think the only thing that could possibly persuade me to get a hand-built bike would be that it would be a tall bike or something equally spectacular. And so it would require me, therefore, to obtain the physical grace necessary to mount and dismount a tall bike. So I'll be asking Brock for some help on that.
Good.
All right. Next question. This is from Craig. Today, I witnessed a first, a parking enforcement officer ticketing a delivery driver for parking illegally in the painted buffer next to the crosswalk at Northeast 8th and Multnomah. This particular spot has seen a constant stream of commercial vehicles illegally parking since demolition began on the Haslow on 8th project a year ago. And in that year, I've probably made 30 calls to the parking enforcement hotline and not once seen a response. This is in the middle of a protected bike lane in the Lloyd District, so it's like really awkward to get out of it and if it's there's something parked in it. How effective is the parking enforcement hotline? Lily.
Well, I wish that we had the stats. I do know that the parking enforcement hotline can only be as effective as the vehicles are there long enough to get into the queue. Essentially, you can't just call someone in and give their license plate number and have them get magically ticketed. That would be neat. But it doesn't work that way. Once you call, it gets put into a queue where after the regular parking enforcement, someone will get sent out to deal with it. So usually if someone's not there for more than 2 hours or more, and especially when it comes to commercial vehicles, I'm sure it actually just slips off the queue because they realize that they're not normally parked longer than 20 minutes. Although I will express that this is on my commute and it's a super frustrating spot. And it's probably the most unsafe part of my whole 1.7 mile commute now. I wish that there was a better solution to it, but, unfortunately, I don't think the parking enforcement hotline is going to be the solution. However, when you call in, it does create data on a map. So every time you call in, even if it's not going to punish the individual drivers, it's at least helping show over time that that's an area of significant problems. So when the city looks to address things, they'll, you know, see that data.
Great. Next question. Our small city is likely to get some neighborhood greenways designated next year. It's looking like we'll get sharrows and 20 miles per hour, but no diverters, bumps, calming, or enforcement. Should we be happy or disappointed? Jonathan.
Well, I think whenever we have one of these neighborhood greenway projects come online that doesn't have the adequate calming or enforcement or traffic diversion baked right in from the start, we're going to be disappointed. We're seeing that happen already on Clinton and on Ankeny right now. But the other part of it is there may be some streets that could work that just have super low auto volume right now that could work as neighborhood greenways. So part of it in sort of the general sense is there should be policy at the city that requires diversion and speed bumps and enforcement to go along with these. But in a specific sense, there may be some sections of some streets where it's not as necessary.
I feel like the problem is that there's no standard for neighborhood greenways. Nobody knows nationally what they're supposed to consider good enough, right? Or there is, but
there are some standards. Yeah, though, right?
NACTO has a standard, but so that's used by some cities. But there's not an official federal standard or anything on definition, I think.
Well, I think the city uses their own standard, at least for average daily traffic volume.
Yeah,
but I don't think they're measuring the qualitative things like how scary it might be and how fast people are passing or what kind of interactions are happening. That kind of stuff's bubbling up from the community, and then they're responding. They hopefully are going to have some response on Clinton, and there's sounds like there may be some diversion coming to Ankeny. Both of those are just from neighborhood associations saying, hey, this isn't working. It's way too many people driving way too fast. So whether or not those issues would be addressed without that community outcry remains to be seen. I would say no.
So you say it's a bad thing if you get the appearance of greenways without the actual quality.
Yeah. And I think ultimately, too, if you look at the city's horizon for planning and becoming more and more dense as the commercial corridors get built up and become more successful, this issue is going to be a much bigger issue. So moving forward, as they establish neighborhood greenways, I mean, I would almost say they should not even be naming them as such without the requisite sort of calming and diversion built in.
Rick asks, when will cycle tracks or multi-use paths be installed on Southwest Multnomah Boulevard from Southwest 40th to Southwest Garden Home Road?
All right. Like lots of things, this is on the bike plan, also known as the kitchen sink plan, as separated in roadway. We actually asked the Portland Bike Coordinator, Roger Geller, about this, and he didn't respond, which is a little unusual for him. And I think it speaks to the fact that this is completely off the city's agenda. I think you're probably asking because there was another improvement nearby on Multnomah in this stretch further east. That was like 6 years in the works and was just finished, and it's okay, but it's not connected to anything. And basically, nobody's sticking their neck out for great infrastructure in Southwest right now. But there is actually a plan in the like sixth year of the street fund to start building protected bikeways in Southwest. So that would be a possible way to get that onto the radar, I guess. All right. Christopher says he watched a Streets Blog video on Berkeley's bike boulevards, and they seem to be similar to our neighborhood greenways, but have more prominent signage and stenciling, he thinks, that the city has done with their boulevards to communicate these roads are being used heavily. This video is from 2007, so before Portland started building its own bike boulevards, which we later renamed as neighborhood greenways. Chris wants to know, would our neighborhood greenways benefit from similar measures to communicate further that streets like Clinton have been set aside as a calm bicycle route? Lily.
Berkeley definitely led the charge in America on these sort of bike boulevard neighborhood greenways, but I actually think that ours are much better these days. Back when we first started doing bike boulevards, before we kind of renamed them neighborhood greenways, the only legal marking we were allowed to use was like less than a foot around. And so you could only see, it was a little circle with a tiny, tiny bike in the middle. And it was really only visible if you were riding a bike and it wasn't worn down. We couldn't get approval to do these huge, huge bike signs. But now we have the sharrows, the sort of larger sharrows, which is a standard marking used in a non-standard way that Portland requested an exception. But we worked really hard as a city to push the federal government to kind of allow us to use this standard marking in a non-standard way, because we knew it was really important that both cars and bikes recognize that it's a bike boulevard. And then a lot of the other stuff that we've done around the signage on bike boulevards on Clinton in particular is great. They did this community art project where you've got the bike art, like these brightly colored bicycles on the side of the road. And then there's a little bike header now on both going and Clinton. Is there any other?
Like on top of the
street signs? On top of the street signs. Yeah, yeah. That's like a cute little brightly colored bike that's sort of cut out, that's put right there. And so they've done a lot of work on making sure that the signage is really great. I think one of the areas in which we're lagging, which Berkeley actually doesn't really have that many of these, but Vancouver, BC has an extensive amount of wayfinding signage for bicycles. We were really doing a great job at it for a while, but we've sort of I don't know if maybe we don't have the funding now or anything, but we haven't updated those ones that tell you how many minutes it takes to bike. And so you can kind of be dropped off in the middle of nowhere by following some wayfinding signage because there isn't another sign. So it's like, oh, I'm going this way to go to PCC Southeast. Oh, but now I don't really know where to turn. So I think that's the biggest improvement, is really those. So I think ours are better than Berkeley's, is my answer to that.
All right. Sweet. Keep it coming.
Alan asks, what's the proper response to a Portland nice driver stopping for me at an intersection when they have the right of way? I'm waiting at the stop sign for you to go by and you're asking me to ride out into the road. Go!
This happens to me all the time. This has become sort of a big, interesting debate here locally in Portland. The thing that I do, and I think that I would recommend everybody else do, is just be as demonstrative as possible that you have no intention of going through the intersection until they legally take their place. I mean, what I do is I stop, I loosen my body language, I step off the bike very obviously. I'll do like a shoulder check both directions so that they know I see them and I see other. And I'm just, you know, sometimes if that doesn't work, I'll yell and I will motion. I'll just say, go, because I look at it like, you know, it's like training a puppy or any. I mean, it's like you got to – every person, every one of these people you meet on the road, you have to actually educate. And if everybody just starts to educate them, then – eventually, people will get the drift.
Even though you know that 60% of people on bikes are just going to take the advantage, if not more.
Hey, that's what this show is for. We're going to try to get that number down.
Yeah.
Right?
That's great.
I like big, smiley body language. The larger you smile while you wave them through, you know, is helpful.
This question is from Brock. What is the best way to combat negativity while hoping for change? There are various ways to interpret that. What do you think, Jonathan?
Well, when I see questions like that, I think people are saying, well, what do we do with the haters? How do we move past that? But I guess there's the other way of looking at it. Like, what about, like you said, the dreamers? What about people that are, I guess you and I are somewhat responsible for that, of pointing out the stagnation issue? I don't know how we should approach that. Which one of those? I think they're both interesting. Well, I mean, for the first one, in addressing haters, the thing I love to do, and I've done it in practice and I've seen it work, I do it quite often on Twitter for people that follow Bike Portland, is that when I see someone who's maybe not as excited about doing great things for cycling as I am, I really don't want to use the word haters, because that's actually a sure way to start a fight. And that's the whole point of my answer, is that if you try to rebut this negativity around biking, everybody just starts yelling and nothing gets solved and we don't have a productive debate. My goal and my idea is to have a productive debate happen, knowing firmly and confidently in my heart that the thing I'm debating for is going to ultimately win out if both sides are heard. And if I didn't believe that, I wouldn't start the argument to begin with. And I've seen that play out. I think the biggest one was when they tried to close Wheeler and Mr. Bob Huckabee threatened some statewide campaign to get bikes licensed and all this stuff. Instead of fighting that guy, even though a lot of people said I should, and actually got a little lambasted by a lot of readers saying, you should, you know, tell that guy he's wrong, I sort of welcomed him in. We actually ended up going on K2 on a TV interview show. We both set our sides. And after that show, which both of our arguments got out on the table, we never heard from that guy again. People realized what he was saying was totally unreasonable, didn't stand up to the merits of, you know, of anything, really. So anyway, that's a good thing for that. In terms of the stagnation and people that are saying, well, people that are concerned maybe there's too much negativity and how do we get beyond that, I think it's important to point out negativity when it's warranted. Portland has a really sort of known and not that great track record of being real with itself and doing the sort of Portland high five where you go up and pat yourself on the back. I think it's super important to acknowledge that things are not as awesome as they should be. And I think we're on the road to doing that. Actually, last year marked what I thought was this watershed moment when we had the city of Portland held a little lunchtime session where they acknowledged, okay, we're stagnating and now what? And here's some new people at PBOT that are going to help us get past that. So acknowledging the problem was sort of the first step. So I think it was important for us to point that out. Next question comes from Aaron. Of all the great transportation activists in Portland, which one would you most like to see run for local office? And a little disclaimer on this one, has to be someone other than Steph Routh, because that's just a given.
Cameron Witten.
Next question.
Alan asks, hated an island, Jansen Beach, Bridgetown, including connections to Vancouver and Marine Drive. Any hope for better/easier biking?
Well, Alan, there is always hope. A lot of people hoped that the Columbia River crossing would address that, and a new I-5 bridge would come with this great new bike lane that we were all promised. That obviously is not happening. At this point right now, maybe perhaps someone could propose a smaller project to get over the river, a smaller bridge that would maybe work. And anything that goes over the river that's new is going to have a better bike connection. That's without a doubt. You know, there's been some good news. There's a new path along the slough that allows you to kind of get to that area. I use it a lot. You know, there's a new bridge over Vancouver that's got a separated bikeway. Unfortunately, I wouldn't say there's a lot of hope for this. There's just not. I don't think the city of Portland or Vancouver sees a big demand for people bicycling across the river. And until they see that, I don't see how this becomes a super urgent issue for them.
There is a new plan by the guy that came up with the alternative to the Columbia River crossing that was most widely circulated. We'll have that on the site in the first few days of the year. Maybe it's already up. Check it out.
Josh G. asks, how disappointed should I be about the lack of direct access from PSU to the South Waterfront? Is $5 million for an overpass route nothing in today's project dollars? Is a retrofit even possible?
I got this. Yes, you should be 60% disappointed. The reason is that the project itself is massively expensive. As you note, $1.5 billion, and they couldn't spare $5 million to make things just totally amazing for bikes to get to the most important bike destination in downtown, perhaps, PSU. The other side of it is this entire project is like $1.5 billion. They were actually scraping for pocket change in the cushions when they made this. They eliminated like things like the caps that protect the wires from cold weather and snow. That's a terrible, terrible idea to eliminate those caps. It's going to be more expensive. They did it anyway because they were so short of cash. So they were genuinely short of cash on this massive project. It's hard to hold it against them. A retrofit is maybe possible, probably possible, a lot harder now that it's all been built. I think we lost this time. And if there had been more activism at the time, we would have perhaps won. I'll ask for Andy. What's the deal with Williams? I was supposed to ask that as Jerry Seinfeld voice. He asks generally, are we learning anything from these botched construction projects that we've seen this year that the city's gone through several of and tried to deal with the problems of after the fact? Jonathan.
The deal with Williams, and I think specifically this person is asking about, like you said, those construction zones and how we had cones flying in the middle of this new bike lane. We had signs everywhere. We had construction projects butting out into the bicycle way. It was just a real mess. That's what the deal was with it. And I think to some degree, the city understands that this is an issue they need to figure out. Can they figure it out? Will they figure it out? Well, there's some hopeful signs and there's some not so hopeful signs. The BTA has been interested in this, so they're putting some staffing power into looking at, you know, creating more of a standardized construction zone right-of-way thing in terms of if you do a construction zone, bicycles have to have at least the same, if not better, access through it.
Oh!
There we go.
Time's up.
Time's up.
One or two more words, Jonathan. You good?
Yeah.
Yeah, deal is it's on the city's radar, but it's going to be a big lift to get standardized construction zone access citywide for bicycling.
I think that's all of our questions for this show, but now it's time to look at our predictions from last year's year in review.
Yeah. Yikes.
And see how we did.
So some of us did better than others. this is so at the end of last year's show, we asked for predictions for the year 2014, the exciting year to come. I'll tell you, I predicted that the Portland street fee would become overwhelmingly the biggest local transportation story of the year. There would be a huge fight, and bikes would be completely sidelined during it. Jonathan is air clapping. Oh, now he's real clapping.
We have a winner.
I'm pretty happy with that prediction.
That was right on.
Yeah. Lily predicted.
I predicted that the Portland bike share would be delayed again and that it would miss its deadline.
Oh, this is so hard. That was a great prediction, really.
It was a completely, yeah. It actually looked at this moment then that we were going to get it for a few months to many of us with less wisdom and foresight than Lily.
The reason I just reacted that way to Lily is because mine was terrible. Okay, here's my cheery prediction for bike share. Bike share will be on the ground by next year for sure. Pin drop. Okay. Yeah. So that was obviously very wrong. I also said that we wouldn't have a lot of forward movement on neighborhood greenways.
Correct.
That whole program has basically been mothballed, and that we would make a lot more forward movement on protected bike lanes.
Not really at all.
Williams got on the ground. Yeah, we got Southwest Multnomah was one of the top 10 in the country, according to People for Bike.
And these were built into the street fee. That's something, as were neighborhood greenways. So I think there's an argument for movement on that.
Basically, that was terrible. My predictions were bad.
Yeah, that's what I was saying. Just try to be nice, boss. All right. And let's move on to 2015. Here's mine. I think that by the end of this year, this to come, there will be a serious and plausible candidate in Portland's 2016 mayoral race who is running against density, road diets, and other urbanist agenda items. I don't think we've seen that in quite a long time in the city of Portland. I think the time is ripe for a populist sort of insurgent person to question all this stuff and force us to have a debate about it, which might actually be good because I think the good guys would win if we actually had the fight.
Not that we're biased.
We're the good guys. We're
apparently
totally objective.
Yeah. My prediction is that this street fee is going to, they're going to bring it up again. It's going to go through council and then it's going to get referred to the ballot. I almost 100% guarantee we'll see a street fee related item, even if it's just a measure trying to block all future street fees, hit either the spring or the fall ballot.
Well, for me, given how bad I did last year on this, I'm going to be a little more safe. And this might not be totally fair since I'll be personally involved in it. But next year, I predict we'll make some real big progress on the issue of bike theft. We had a Portland Bike Theft Summit a couple weeks ago. It went really well. And there's lots of really good momentum right now. And there's people coming out of the woodwork with great ideas and lots of good partnerships coming together. So I am positive that by next year we're going to see some big initiatives come together and bike theft's going to be squarely on the radar and being worked on in Portland.
Stay tuned next year.
And that's our show.
That's our show.
You can subscribe to the show at bikeportland.org/podcast and make your New Year's resolution to send us any comments you have about the show at podcast@bikeportland.org.
You can spread the word about the show by searching for Bike Portland on iTunes and leaving a review.
You can follow me at Anomalily on Twitter.
And you can follow at Bike Portland on Twitter and Facebook, too. I'm Jonathan Maas, Bike Portland's publisher.
I'm Mike Anderson, Bike Portland's news editor.
And I'm Lillian Kerbake, your podcast producer. Thanks for listening. Until next time, remember to exit through the back,
pass on the left,
and don't forget to thank your bus driver.